Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop, Update in the Treatment of Bladder Cancer. And this is a program that we're really very delighted to be offering to all of you, and it's being done in collaboration with the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, who actually have helped us with this program and have helped actually to support the program as well. And you'll be hearing more about the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network as the program goes on. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care, the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 417 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Lebanon, the Philippines, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So it's a bit of a global call as well. And today's program was supported by a grant from Genentech, the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, and the Diana Napoli Fund. And we really want to thank them all for their support of this program and making it possible so that we could bring this wonderful information to all of you. Now, we have really wonderful speakers on our program today. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Walter Stadler. Dr. Stadler is the Fred C. Buffett Professor of Medicine and Surgery, Section Chief, Hematology Oncology, University of Chicago. And Dr. Stadler is going to present an overview of bladder cancer, including the role of surgery and the standard of care, the role of diagnostic testing in determining treatment options, the benefits of personalized care in predicting response to treatment, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to actually turn this program over to Dr. Stadler.
Hi, and thank you very much, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to be here, and I likewise want to thank both Cancer Care and Beacon, the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, for sponsoring this program. I was going to spend a few minutes talking about an overview of bladder cancer, at least from the initial diagnosis perspective, and then let my colleague, Dr. Malowski, take it from that, from a more advanced perspective. I'm going to, start out simply by saying that bladder cancer, for those of us who treat it a lot, think of this as a disease of really two different subtypes. The first is a disease that is really made of low-grade cancers, typically almost a warty-like growth in the bladder that is typically removed or resected by urologists through a what we call a cystoscope, essentially an instrument that's placed into the urethra, and then the tumors are removed, and sometimes the urologist will also use additional medicines in the bladder. I'm actually not going to spend any time discussing this particular disease because it is a significant health problem, and there's lots of issues surrounding this particular health condition, but it is typically not life-threatening. What I would like to focus on more is the life-threatening version of bladder cancer, which typically starts out as a condition called carcinoma in situ, and then rapidly often progresses to what we call a muscle-invasive bladder cancer. That is a cancer that escapes the interior lining of the bladder and begins to invade into the muscle layers of the bladder. The reason that this is important and at least potentially life-threatening is that this allows the bladder cancer cells access to the blood vessels and the lymph vessels that then can lead to metastases or spread of the cancer to other sites in the body. So patients who are diagnosed with these kind of more aggressive cancers typically are diagnosed by a urologist, and once again, through these cystoscopic processes, in other words, the insertion of an instrument through the urethra where they can look at the inside of the bladder and then also obtain some biopsies. And an obvious question then becomes how patients get to a urologist, and typically the most common symptom that that leads to these diagnoses is blood in the urine, and certainly blood in the urine that is seen by the patient typically leads to the evaluation by a urologist, and this is typically how this diagnosis is made. So in addition to looking in the bladder and obtaining a biopsy for patients who have been diagnosed with muscle-invasive bladder cancer, we also obtain CAT scans. These are CAT scans usually of the abdomen and pelvis, and the purpose of these scans is to look to see if there is any evidence of cancer having spread outside the bladder, typically to lymph nodes, which is the first place that these cancers spread to. Now, if there is no evidence for spread of cancer to the lymph nodes, and if there is muscle-invasive cancer, I think one of the next important parts of the evaluation really is the consultation or the evaluation by a medical oncologist, which is a physician who specializes in the use of drugs, typically, to treat cancers. And the reason that, you know, I've emphasized that is that patients with muscle-invasive disease are also often treated or should often be treated with additional chemotherapy prior to any other local treatment, such as surgery and or radiation. Now, the decision as to whether any individual patient should get such chemotherapy is a complex decision that's based in part on what the urologists see, in part on the CT scan, and in part on other medical issues and problems, including important things such as kidney function and renal function. The whether chemotherapy is done first or not, the other obvious important issue is then how the local tumor or the local cancer in the bladder is addressed. And here there are two options. One option is surgical removal of the bladder, and the second option is radiation, typically radiation in the combination with additional chemotherapy at the same time. And I think that, you know, one thing that I emphasize to patients is that the care of locally advanced bladder cancer is a multidisciplinary exercise. It is an exercise that requires, I think, the input of urologists, the input of medical oncologists, and often the input of radiation oncologists. And I think it's important for patients to understand that getting these different opinions and having the input of these different specialties is an important component of maximizing the quality of the care that is received. And I think that in many ways, probably the biggest mistake, if we can call it a mistake, is that patients and sometimes physicians are in a hurry to do something and will do the first thing that they hear rather than spending a little bit of time thinking about what the right thing to do might be. And what I usually explain to patients is that these are cancers that, yes, they are serious. Yes, they are potentially life-threatening, but these are cancers that have taken, if not months, years to grow, and spending a little bit of time at getting consultations and getting an understanding of the disease, getting an understanding of the options, and getting the right answer for your care is much more important than getting the fast answer. I think that, you know, the other part of this that I emphasize is that especially when it comes to things like surgery and radiation therapy, that there are technical aspects to this care, and that it does matter who and what institution do these kind of procedures, if for no other reason that practice makes perfect, and that institutions where not only the physicians, but the nurses, the allied personnel, the physicists who do the radiation planning are all very familiar with this disease, see these issues a lot, and are familiar with the potential complications. And whenever there are technically challenging aspects of medical care, outcomes are always better at institutions where there is a high volume of that particular care. Now, one thing that comes up a lot is the issue of what I call the plumbing when one removes the bladder. Obviously, the major purpose of the bladder is to store urine, which, as I have said, is to store urine until there's a socially acceptable time to empty it. And if you remove the bladder, we need to, in essence, redo that plumbing. And there's a number of options for that. Once again, even that is a long discussion, but in brief, one can simply create a conduit so that the urine empties into a bag that's attached to the abdominal wall. One can create a what we call a continent diversion, where once again the urine empties out into a what we call a stoma, or a small hole on the abdominal wall, but there's no bag, and in essence there's a storage bag made of intestines that's in the abdomen, and the urine is emptied through a catheter. Or there can be the urine can be hooked, in essence the similar intestinal storage can be hooked up to the urethra so that patients, you know, urinate at least semi-normally through the urethra. These are, there are advantages and disadvantages to each one of these approaches. One is not necessarily, quote, better than the other, and I think they, you know, an important conversation for patients and their caregivers to have with the urologist is the various options and which one might be best for you. I think that, you know, once surgery and or radiation is complete, there is often, I think, additional monitoring that needs to be performed for patients. I think there needs to be a good understanding of what that monitoring would be like, and which may vary based on what the findings at surgery might be, if surgery is the initial therapy. And then I think that there are also, I think, very critical and important roles for the nurses and other members of the healthcare team, simply in regards to learning how to utilize, in essence, you know, the new plumbing that is created, or to deal with whatever issues or complications may show up from some of this therapy. And certainly one of the issues that often patients, family members, and even doctors are reluctant to discuss are some of the sexual effects of these treatments, and that is certainly something that I would also encourage patients and their loved ones and partners to bring up with their healthcare team, because there are a number of approaches and solutions to these common problems, but in reality, many people will not discuss them unless they're brought up first by patients. So I will mention that as an important issue from a, you know, communicating with your healthcare team. There are other things, obviously, that I could spend hours speaking about, but I'll end, you know, my brief introduction here and turn it over back to Dr. Messner and Dr. Malowski to talk about some of the other issues that might be relevant for patients who have more advanced disease.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stadler, for that really excellent presentation, very very comprehensive and very informative for everybody, and really set the whole stage for the whole program today, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Matthew Malowski. Dr. Malowski is Associate Professor of Medicine, Section Chief, Genitourinary Oncology, Division of Hematology and Oncology, UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, Clinic Medical Director, North Carolina Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Malowski is going to address new and emerging treatment approaches and clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, and managing treatment side effects. It's really my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Malowski.
So thank you, Dr. Messner, and Cancer Care and the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network for the opportunity to discuss these important topics. And so as Dr. Messner said, I'll start with new and emerging treatment approaches and clinical trials. And here what I'll try to do is focus really on targeted therapies and new immune therapies in bladder cancer. And so the 30-plus years of really no major advances in the treatment of patients with advanced or metastatic bladder cancer has truly come to an end. Chemotherapy, which has been the current standard of care for patients with advanced or metastatic disease, remains the standard of care. It is effective, although it is unfortunately unable to eradicate or cure the disease in the great majority of patients with metastatic disease. New and emerging treatment approaches and clinical trials for patients with all stages of bladder cancer are happening now, and the future looks really incredibly bright. So the two major advances in particular that have led to tremendous excitement among bladder cancer clinical researchers are, one, a new understanding of the genetics of bladder cancer, and the second is the promise of new immune therapies in the treatment of many malignancies, including bladder cancer. And so first I'll speak to the understanding of the genetics of bladder cancer. The Cancer Genome Atlas, or TCGA, is a National Institute of Health, or NIH-sponsored, comprehensive and coordinated effort to accelerate our understanding of the molecular basis of cancer. And it is done through performing in-depth genetic analysis of tumors, including bladder cancer. And so the TCGA analysis of bladder cancer was published in the journal Nature in January of 2014. And what it suggested was that up to 70% of genetic changes in bladder cancers may in fact be actionable. And what that means is that these changes may represent potential targets for new targeted therapies. And so this represents what we've heard of as a precision medicine type of approach, where a specific genetic change or multiple genetic changes within an individual's tumor can provide a sort of roadmap for the use of a drug targeting the specific genetic events within the tumor. And in many other malignancies, including lung cancer, breast cancer, head and neck cancers, stomach cancers, as well as others, this approach has been very successful. In fact, similar genetic events that have been successfully targeted in other cancers, such as breast cancer, represent potential genetic targets in bladder cancer. And so one example is the ERBB2 or HER2 family of genes, which is also altered in several different ways in bladder cancer, similar to breast cancer. And so agents such as trastuzumab, or otherwise called Herceptin, and others may have activity in select patients who harbor such genetic changes. And in fact, work from Dr. Stadler's group at the University of Chicago has suggested that genetic alterations in this particular family of genes may predict sensitivity to another drug that targets this particular pathway called afatinib. And Investigational clinical trials are absolutely critical for defining subgroups of patients who are most likely to respond to these targeted therapies, with several ongoing and planned trials that are in development related to specific genetic changes. Another example is the National Cancer Institute Molecular Analysis for Therapy Choice, which is otherwise called an NCI match, which is a clinical trial that analyzes patients' tumors to determine whether they contain specific genetic abnormalities for which a targeted drug exists, and then assigns a treatment based on the abnormality in bladder cancer as a potential tumor that's included in this particular clinical trial as well. I'll also mention a soon-to-be-launched effort by the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network's Bladder Cancer Genomics Consortium called Urothelial Cancer Genomic Analysis to Improve Patient Outcomes and Research, or what we call the UC Genome effort, that will perform next-generation DNA sequencing, in other words, analysis of DNA or the genetics on 200 patients' tumors with advanced bladder cancer to better understand the genetic makeup of these tumors, to point to potential genetic changes that may represent targets for clinical trials or other targeted therapies. And the effort will also create a rich biospecimen bank, so there will be tumor samples, including DNA, RNA, blood samples that will be able to be used for future collaborative scientific research. So this is very exciting. The second advance involves new immune therapies, and specifically the use of what are called the new immune checkpoint inhibitors, including the PD-1, which is also called Programmed Cell Death Protein 1, and PD-L1, or Programmed Death Ligand 1 inhibitors. And so these are the PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors. And so the immune system is designed to attack foreign agents such as bacteria and viruses in order to keep us healthy. And tumors may also be recognized by the immune system as foreign. However, our body has this complex system to literally put the brakes on the immune response such that we don't overdo it and wreak complete havoc on our bodies every time we encounter something foreign, because this could lead to something called autoimmune diseases, where we essentially attack our own organ systems. And so this system involves these molecules PD-1 and PD-L1, which, when activated, put the brakes on the immune response. This also, unfortunately, leads to the inability of our immune system under certain circumstances to really adequately attack a growing tumor. And so new agents that block PD-1 and PD-L1 essentially unleash the immune system and have led to extremely promising activity in patients with advanced or metastatic bladder cancer. And so two of these drugs, one called pembrolizumab and the other called atezolizumab, were shown in two clinical trials to have responses in patients with metastatic bladder cancer. And many of the patients who have these responses, the responses seem to be quite durable or long-lasting. And with that, I'll say that we still have a lot more to learn regarding the durability of these responses, and that is how long the responses can last. And many clinical trials are currently ongoing. In addition, we also need to learn more about how to select those patients who are most likely to respond to these new immune checkpoint inhibitors. And there's some information in bladder cancer and in other diseases suggesting that we can actually stain or look in the tumors for PD-L1 expression using specific stains, and that may help us to be able to select those patients who have a greater likelihood of responding. In addition to metastatic disease, trials are ongoing and planned in patients with earlier stages of bladder cancer, including non-muscle invasive bladder cancer and what Dr. Stadler was describing in muscle invasive bladder cancer. And so these are before the development of more advanced disease. So these have been extraordinarily exciting developments in the field. So how does research contribute to your treatment options? So ongoing research and specifically clinical trials have led already to the exploration of many novel targeted therapies. And as I've already described, in the great potential for some of these immune checkpoint inhibitors in patients with advanced bladder cancer. And so it's really critical that patients with bladder cancer be given the opportunity and do participate in clinical trials. This is really the only way that we'll continue to develop effective therapies for the disease. the recent advances in the disease, I will tell you, have opened the eyes of many researchers to the potential for new bladder cancer therapies, and this has really created a boom in the field of bladder cancer-related research with many new, young, bright investigators beginning their research careers with the goal of studying bladder cancer and developing new, exciting treatments. And this has been really exciting for me, and I'm sure Dr. Stadler and others to watch as well. In terms of managing the side effects of treatment, here again, what I'll do is I'll focus really on the management and side effects related to some of these novel targeted therapies and immune therapies rather than the side effects that are attributable to more standard chemotherapy. And so the management of treatment-related side effects is crucial in order to be able to provide effective therapies for patients with this disease. And again, I thought I'd focus more on these targeted therapeutics and immune therapies because there's really a new spectrum of side effects that may be associated with targeted therapies and immune therapies. And so starting with targeted therapies, in spite of being targeted, these treatments are not without side effects, although the type of side effects in general differ from the classic side effects of chemotherapy. And so depending on the specific targeted therapy, the side effects may include fatigue, lowering of the blood cell counts, but generally this is much less so as compared to classic chemotherapy. Thyroid dysfunction, lung inflammation, there can be heart-related side effects, rashes, kidney problems, mouth sores. Some may include increased risk for infection as well as others. And so when initiating a targeted therapy, typically in the context of a clinical trial where these are given, it is extremely important that a patient review the potential side effects related to the drug with his or her doctor. And reporting any side effects to your doctor is necessary to ensure that your problem is addressed quickly. It's also important to recognize that it may be the case that an unknown side effect is discovered in the context of a clinical trial of a new drug, and you've now brought that new side effect to the attention of your physician. In general, the side effects are manageable if brought to your doctor's attention quickly. The management may include dose reduction or holding the treatment for some defined period of time, starting medication to combat the toxicity, with an example being thyroid hormone supplementation for low thyroid hormone levels, which can otherwise contribute to significant fatigue. So what about the new immune therapies? Both doctors and patients need to be familiar with the potential for immune-related side effects associated with the new checkpoint inhibitor, PD-1 and PD-L1 drugs. And these side effects are related to the immune system attacking the normal organs, such as the lung, the kidney, or the liver, which can result in inflammation in these organs, the pituitary gland, the gland which sits in the brain, which can include things like adrenal insufficiency and its associated symptoms. It can attack the pancreas, leading to diabetes, the colon, so patients can have significant diarrhea, rashes, as well as others. And here, the treatment may involve the use of steroids and holding or stopping the drug. And it's very important that some of these immune-related side effects may actually not be reversible. And so early recognition and treatment is critical. And there's a tremendous amount of excitement in the field from all of us that regularly take care of patients with this disease. It's really an extraordinary time. And so with this, I'll stop, and I will look forward to questions later in the program. And thank you again for the opportunity to contribute today.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mielewski. That was really excellent and really lots of information for people to absorb and just very helpful. Thank you. And there will be questions for you, I'm sure, during the Q&A. Thanks. Our next speaker is Dr. Stephanie Chisholm, and Dr. Chisholm is Director of Education and Research, Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, BCAN, Dr. Chisholm is going to address the free support programs from the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, BCAN. And many of you may know of this organization, but for those of you who don't, it's a wonderful resource. And Stephanie also has been just really very instrumental in making today's program possible. And also she's going to describe the Survivor to Survivor program as well. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Chisholm.
Oh, thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm really delighted to be able to be part of this program. For many people, a diagnosis of bladder cancer is really sort of a scary situation where you don't know where to go for information. And I do hope that many people will visit our website, www.bcan.org. www.cancerinfo.org, because when they get there, we have a lot of comprehensive bladder cancer information. We have a lot of basic information for people who are newly diagnosed as well as people who are long-term survivors. And one of the things that I'd like to just share with you is a little bit about our Survivor to Survivor program. We have a number of volunteers who are specially trained to speak directly to a patient who might have some questions about what life is really like with bladder cancer. And so people are able to be connected to someone with very similar circumstances, so they actually have a chance for some very candid conversation about perhaps if they have to have their bladder removed or any of the treatments that they might have to have. What was the real experience really all about? So it's a wonderful opportunity to connect with somebody who really does know what they're going through. We have a number of other resources, including our connections, where if people go to our website, they can find out all the information about how to access that, but you can meet with some volunteers and get all of the different resources that we have available. And our online resource center is a really rich amount of videos and short snippets that are very, very beneficial. We have conversations, Let's Talk About Bladder Cancer, where our co-founder has interviewed many experts talking about key issues like sexuality or fear of recurrence or even proper treatments and things along those lines. But we also have a number of very candid videos about patients who needed to have their bladder removed, where they discussed their choice of urinary diversion and really looked at why they made those decisions. And for some patients, that could be very beneficial to take a look at those as they're beginning to talk with their physicians about their treatment options. So I hope that people will go visit our website, www.bcan.org.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Chisholm. That was really excellent and very informative, and we do encourage everyone to visit the CAN website. That's terrific. And our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlund. Ms. Edlund is an oncology social worker, and she's our online support group program director at Cancer Care. And Ms. Edlund is going to address the free psychosocial support programs from Cancer Care and our support groups. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Edlund.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of the call today. And I would like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with bladder cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. In fact, we offer an online support group specifically dedicated to the needs and experiences of bladder cancer patients. You can register for the group on Cancer Care's website at www.cancercare.org. This group and our groups in general offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your family. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help. So please contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website, again, at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. And thank you so much for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Well, thank you so much, Caroline. That was really wonderful and just a wonderful resource for everybody. And also there is the online support group that many of you may be interested in for people with bladder cancer. And also from BCAN, there is also their Survivor to Survivor program. So there's lots of resources for all of you. We don't want you to feel like there is, and there are so many other resources as well that both organizations offer. We don't want anyone to feel that you don't have access to them. So thank you. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm really thankful to our speakers. So I'm going to ask actually Stephanie to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. And Stephanie, would you bring all of our speakers on board so that they're all here and ready to answer all the questions that come in? And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, I'll give you guidelines of how to get them answered at the end of today's program. But for right now, we're going to try to actually take as many of your questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Again, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone to ask a question.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, actually, from Stacy. So I'm going to, Stacy, I'm going to try to summarize your questions. She's writing about her husband had renal cancer with ileal conduit last June and has been plagued by digestive problems ever since, primarily diarrhea. His medical team at a top center has had difficulty with this lingering side effect. And so her question is, what do you tell patients and what are your dietary recommendations, especially since the portion of small intestine that is used is the portion that would otherwise remove water from stool and absorb fats and nutrients. Now, today's program is certainly about bladder cancer, so not renal cancer, so I'm just wondering if any of our speakers could just address this in a general way, either Dr. Stadler or Dr. Malowski, just to give some general guidelines in terms of just even bringing up these issues again with the medical team, representing a dietitian, any ideas that might be helpful in terms of working with their oncologist and surgeon. Even though it's a bit of a step away from the talk today, just a general.
Well, I think that this is Dr. Stadler, and I do think that this is, this is not a uncommon side effect of this therapy, and I think that the first thing is to make sure to discuss this with the urologists and the urology team, including the nurses who work with these patients. I think they often have lots of good, simple solutions, which include, things like fiber products, sometimes some products to slow down the motility of the of the gut. Occasionally, there can be more significant issues that need to be addressed, and we do sometimes have to refer patients to gastroenterologists to get their assistance and help, and I think that that's another avenue to potentially pursue.
And thank you. Actually, Stacy has corrected me. It's a radical cystectomy, so he did have bladder cancer. Okay, that's very helpful.
Correct.
Thank you. Thanks. Sorry. Thank you, Stacy, for that correction. And Dr. Malowski, did you want to add anything? Or
no, I agree completely with Dr. Stadler. I think when these cases become complicated, that engaging gastroenterologists can often be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So, Stacy, do you recommend that you actually go back to your treating healthcare team, involve various members? If you're still having difficulties, I would call certainly the BCAN and Cancer Care for other thoughts about things you can do that would be helpful to you, and I hope that's helpful to you as a resource. Now we have a question from one of our online participants. So here it's a similar question. So can you discuss long-term digestive complications post-radical cystectomy? So that's actually a very similar question, but is there anything you'd want to add to that from that question?
So, Dr. Stadler here again. There tend to be relatively few long-term digestive problems aside from some of this diarrhea. Occasionally, based on the details of the, in essence, the reconstruction, there can be electrolyte problems, and that's usually seen on laboratory analyses. Also, rarely we can have some problems with absorption of vitamins, such as vitamin B12. These kind of problems were more common many years ago with some of the older reconstructions. They tend to be a much less common problem with the current reconstructions that the urologists create.
Excellent. Thank you. And Stacey, our next question.
Our next question comes from Laura G. Your line is open.
Yes, I wondered if the immunology and also the genetic solutions that you're talking about, or alternatives you're talking about, are they only for TCC, or is there anything being developed for squamous or adenocarcinoma?
Thank you for that question. Dr. Malowski, would you want to address that question?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. So bladder cancer, like most cancers, comes in different flavors, and 5% of bladder cancers or so are squamous cell cancers purely, and about 2% are or adenocarcinomas, and that reflects what you're speaking to in your question. Is there some approach to look at those? And so the majority of the work now that has been done has really been more specific to transitional cell, or otherwise called urothelial cell carcinoma, but there are certainly ongoing efforts that are looking at some of these less common histologic subtypes like squamous cell cancers, adenocarcinoma, small cell cancers of the bladder, as well as bladder cancer also can include some of these other appearances under the microscope with urothelial or transitional cell cancer. And so now that we've gathered this better understanding of the most common type of bladder cancer, people are definitely doing those deeper dives into looking at these other subtypes of bladder cancer. And I suspect that over the next couple of years, we're going to begin to hear more and more related to those issues.
I have a question for Dr. Stadler from one of our online participants above. Dr. Stadler mentioned the importance of choosing the right doctors for treatment based on which clinic has treated the most patients with this particular condition. And so the question is, what is the best way to research for the best medical team, as most clinic sites do not mention how much experience that they have had with a particular diagnosis? So that's an excellent question. And Dr. Stadler, can you address it in a general way just to help people to really, it is really important, of course, to find the very best healthcare team, and if you could have any other suggestions for this participant.
Yes, and you know, I don't think that there are any, you know, hard and fast rules here. But I do think it's perfectly fair for patients to ask their healthcare providers, you know, how often do you see patients with muscle invasive bladder cancer? How many surgeries like this, you know, have you done? How many of these, you know, do you do a year in your institution? As I said, I don't think I can give you a number that is, you know, an absolute number, but I would certainly say that any center that does, you know, 10 or fewer, you know, cystectomies a year probably has a difficulty developing the, you know, the appropriate expertise for caring for these patients, because, you know, you see one patient a month or so now. That doesn't mean that certain centers, you know, they may be very good and they may be in rural areas, and that may be the best that, you know, you can obtain. But I think it's fair to ask the question and, in essence, you know, force the healthcare team to address them.
And Dr. Chisholm from BCAN, do you actually, when people call, are you able to help them with this question as well in terms of resources perhaps in their community that you know of, or is that something you can provide?
We definitely encourage everyone to specifically ask their doctor about their functional outcomes, like what are the results of some of the treatments that they've done. And certainly, you know, don't feel shy about asking your doctor for some information about their experience treating your particular situation. And then at the same time, don't be afraid of asking for a second opinion. And I would think that Dr. Stadler and Dr. Malowski would agree that, you know, a second opinion is not a failure of confidence in your doctor, but you just want a confirmation before you make your decision on treatments.
Dr. Malowski and Dr. Stadler, do you want to comment on that, the second opinion concept?
Yeah, it's Malowski. I mean, I think that, you know, I always tell patients there's no ego in the room. I mean, it's important that people feel comfortable with their healthcare provider, and the way to do that is to ask the right questions. And I think Dr. Stadler is spot on in making sure that as a patient you understand what the resources at the particular place you're going to are, and ask very directed questions related to how many surgical procedures, how many patients with bladder cancer have been treated, and what are the outcomes from a surgical standpoint? Because if you're going to pursue your care at that particular place, I mean, it's important that you really have the answers to all of those questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I often tell, you know, patients and families, if a doctor tells you you don't need a second opinion, that might be the first reason to get one.
That's an excellent recommendation. We have a question from Diane. What percentage of radical bladder removal is done as open surgery? Perplexed about this recommendation from my 85-year-old dad. Doesn't that increase the risk for post-op infection and cell recovery at his advanced age? So perhaps the question also has to do with age and treatment, and I'm wondering if Dr. Stadler, if you can just address that in terms of what age represents and whether there are comorbid issues or what exactly, how you make decisions about what people, which treatments people get, because is it based simply on age or is it based on other factors as well?
So certainly as we all get older, then our ability to tolerate major medical procedures decreases on average. But I think I would be very careful in terms of just setting a, you know, an absolute age cutoff. There are, you know, patients in their 80s who are otherwise robust and could very well tolerate a major surgery, whereas others in their, you know, 60s may be less able to due to other, you know, medical issues. So I think that age in itself should not preclude one therapy over another. I think that the other question that I hear as part of this is what I suspect may be some concern about open surgery versus perhaps robotic surgery or laparoscopic surgery. And I think that we all recognize that surgeries are over time becoming less invasive, so to speak. However, what I emphasize is that the most important issue is who is at the end of the surgical instrument and not what's between you and the operator. The experience matters, and just because it's a robot does not necessarily mean that it is better, easier, or has less side effects. It is really sort of the surgical skill and approach that drives that much into a much greater degree.
Thank you. Excellent. This is very important, and I hope that was helpful to you. Our next question comes from Joan. Is BCG a viable direction for the initial diagnosis of high-grade non-invasive tumor? I've had low-grade removed for the last 5 years, but just diagnosed with the high-grade.
This is Dr. Stadler, and this addresses, you know, the issue that I said I wouldn't talk a lot about, but that's okay. I think it's a very fair question. most of these non-invasive tumors are low-grade, but occasionally they are high-grade, and we worry a little bit more about these high-grade tumors and their risk for becoming invasive. And certainly BCG is a standard of care for these tumors, and it's BCG that's instilled directly into the bladder, and that would in general be appropriate, but obviously the details of the individual case are critical.
And there, another question from one of our online participants, from Jane. What is the risk of the cancer returning? Are there signs and symptoms I should watch for? So Dr. Malowski, could you address that question?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot to this question. As Dr. Stadler pointed out, the majority of bladder cancers are localized to the bladder, and so under those circumstances, patients just need to be followed by their urologist with regular evaluations using a cystoscope to look within the bladder, urine cytology tests, which examine the cells in the urine under the microscope. And when following with a urologist closely, these sort of recurrences, particularly as related to low-grade and even high-grade type disease localized to the bladder, could be managed quite effectively. Obviously, symptoms such as burning with urination or increased frequency of urination or blood in the urine do not always represent bladder cancer recurrence, even in the context of someone with a history of bladder cancer. Things like urinary tract infections and other issues can occur as well, but those are the sort of things that should certainly be brought to the attention of your physician. With patients with more advanced disease, these patients are also typically followed closely by their physicians, and they have regular blood work and imaging studies such as CAT scans, as Dr. Stadler mentioned, that would be helpful in determining whether there's been any evidence of a recurrence of the disease.
Excellent. Thank you. We have another question. How will this treatment affect my daily life? Will I be able to work, exercise, and perform my usual activities? Dr. Stadler, could you address that?
Well, I think that that's exactly the question that patients should ask their healthcare providers and their healthcare team. The answer to that question depends completely on the therapy we're talking about. If we're talking about local therapy, I think that, we expect the vast majority of patients to continue to do their activities as they did before. There are many, many aspects to this, and just bringing up, one particular one is, if one, for example, has a question about the, which urinary diversion one should use, whether it be a bag or a neobladder or a continent diversion, I think it's important for the patient and his or her family to give the healthcare team a sense of what you do on a regular basis, and then ask the question how these different surgeries and things might have an impact.
Excellent, thank you. And another question from Jonathan. How do you diagnose UTIs after radical cystectomy? Dr. Malowski, do you want to address that?
Yeah, it can be complicated because there could be, in patients who have diversions, colonization of bacteria. And so just having bacteria or even white blood cells can sometimes be complicated when testing a urine sample. And so there may be other symptoms that can go along with infection, for example, fever, or patients can also have particularly high white blood cell counts, foul-smelling urine, increased bacteria counts within the urine. But this is an area that that can be quite complicated, and urologists tend to manage these issues and, in general, do it quite well. And sometimes it requires just following patients a little bit more chronically to determine whether or not something truly represents an infection or seems to be more consistent with simply bacterial colonization, that is bacteria that is there but is not causing any problems for the patient.
Excellent. These are really outstanding questions, I have to say, and I appreciate our speakers. This is quite the tour de force of answering all these questions. There's a late-breaking question from Melanie, which is a very interesting question. Is there any treatment, are there any treatments being considered using stem cell research? My mother was just diagnosed with bladder cancer, and we are having a baby in a few months. Would it be beneficial to store the stem cells in the baby's umbilical cord for any type of treatment? Dr. Malowski, could you address that question? It's very interesting. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, so for one, there is, sort of stem cell research that is ongoing related to all malignancies, including bladder cancer. And so it is an area of active research. There's not a therapy or therapy necessarily on the horizon at the moment. I think that there's still a lot of work to be done with respect to research in this area. There's not a specific indication to store the blood under specific circumstances as related to your parent. There are obviously a lot of other good reasons why it could potentially be important to store umbilical blood, which could potentially be used for the purposes of stem cell transplant in other diseases, for example, in other individuals or in major donor banks. I think there's a lot more to learn specific to bladder cancer and other malignancies, but there are obviously places now where, for example, with transplant, that stem cells are currently used and could provide cure to some patients with, for the most part, blood-based type cancers.
Excellent. Excellent. And so we recommend, Melanie, that you may go back to your treating healthcare team and have a discussion with them about your thoughts about this and how, what you might want to plan to do. And there is another question that is different, but to some extent people have a couple of questions. Is bladder cancer hereditary? Is there screening available for my children? So Dr. Stabler, could you address that question in a general way? And
yeah, most bladder cancer is not considered to be hereditary, and in fact, it is a cancer that's most closely associated with environmental exposures, and the most important environmental exposure worldwide and even in this country is smoking, and there is little doubt that we could have a major impact on the incidence of bladder cancer simply by cutting out all smoking. So that, I think, is the most important risk factor. I think that there have been a number of studies that have looked at ways of screening smokers or former smokers for bladder cancer. To date, those have not been as effective as we would like. But there are no, genetic tests per se that could lead to a diagnosis of predisposition to bladder cancer.
Thank you. And our last question, Dr. Malowski, you may have addressed this in part, but are there specific clinical trials ongoing on immunotherapy for bladder cancer?